to Switchblade Sisters, where women get together to slice and dice our favorite action and genre films. I'm April Wolf. Every week, I invite a new female filmmaker on, a writer, director, actor, or producer, and we talk in depth about one of their fave genre films, perhaps one that influenced their own work in some small way. And you may already know, we are reminding you now that we are recording remotely. So I'm in my bedroom, cat sleeping behind me, might wake up, might be birds, might be leaf blowers. Audio is going to sound just a little bit different from our studios, but you know, everything else is going to be the same, except for today, our guest is someone who I'm very excited to have. I've been a big fan for a long time. We have writer-director Catherine Hardwick here with us. Hi.
Hey, how's it going?
You know, as okay as it can be. What do we say to that anymore? What do we say? It's just angry, sad. I don't know.
Frustrated, but trying to figure out a way to be part of the change.
Yeah. Catherine just came back from a march herself. So let me give a quick intro for those of you who just need a refresher on Catherine's career and maybe want to know where she got her start. Because Catherine holds a Bachelor of Architecture from UT Austin. I did not know that about you. But she did graduate work in animation at UCLA Film School. After school, she worked as a production designer on films directed by Richard Linklater, David O. Russell, Cameron Crowe, and Lisa Cholodenko. But her first film as a director was the critically acclaimed 13, which won numerous awards, including the Director's Award at Sundance, along with Golden Globe nominations for Holly Hunter and Evan Rachel Wood, an Academy Award nomination for Holly Hunter, and an Independent Spirit Award for Nikki Reed. Catherine has since then become best known as the director of Twilight, which launched the blockbuster franchise, which everyone knows, the Twilight Saga, and earned nearly $400 million at the global box office. Her current project, Don't Look Deeper, stars Don Cheadle, Emily Mortimer, and Helena Howard. It follows a young woman who's fighting a looming feeling that there is just something fundamentally different about her. And she's right. But the revelation of what she is and where she comes from sets in motion a series of events that suddenly put her entire life in jeopardy. So Don't Look Deeper is going to be released in 15 10-minute long episodes on Quibi, mobile first, so everyone should be downloading that app. And when is that coming out, though?
Well, we were coming out June 8th, and then because of, you know, the new crisis, we are moving, they're figuring out a new date, probably in a couple weeks. Yeah.
Okay. So we'll just keep an eye out for it, because lots of favorites in this episode or in this series. So it was very exciting. Catherine, the movie that you chose to talk about today is Gattaca. And I was wondering, could you give us a little explanation on why this is one of your fave genre films?
Well, I love the movie Gattaca. I had only really seen it, you know, when it first came out in the 90s. And then when we were doing this project, Don't Look Deeper, you know, it's set in the near future, like 15 minutes in the future. And mm-hmm. there are a lot of things that are grounded in the show I just did, Don't Look Deeper. But there are just little tweaks to the future. All of them feel believable. So I looked back to Gattaca. Oh, I always remembered some really striking, beautiful images in that, the mm-hmm. feeling and the mood. So, you know, that was maybe an inspiration, you know, in a way, in some ways for Don't Look Deeper.
I can definitely see that. And knowing that you have a degree in architecture makes sense, which I'm going to bring up later on. But for those of you who haven't seen Gattaca, today's episode will give you some spoilers, obviously. But that shouldn't stop you from listening before you watch. As always, my motto is that it's not what happens, but how it happens that makes a movie worth watching. Still, if you would like to pause and watch Gattaca first, this is your shot. And now that you're back, let me introduce Gattaca with a quick synopsis to remind you what happens. Written and directed by Andrew Niccol for release in 1997, Gattaca stars Ethan Hawke as Vincent Freeman, a man who was conceived without genetic manipulation, who is considered an, quote, invalid in this future eugenics world, meaning he's relegated to a life of menial labor.
I'll never understand what possessed my mother to put her faith in God's hands rather than those of her local geneticist. 10 fingers, 10 toes, that's all that used to matter. Not now. Now, only seconds old, the exact time and cause of my death was already known.
All the valids, however, get to sit high and mighty, nobody questioning if they are, in fact, more qualified for what they're doing. So Vincent's younger brother, Anton, is actually a valid. When they're kids, the two play chicken and swim out to the ocean pretty regularly. Vincent loses every time, except for the last time. And he has to save Anton from drowning.
It was the one moment in our lives that my brother was not as strong as he believed, and I was not as weak. It was the moment that made everything else possible.
It's that incident that makes Vincent feel like he has to leave home. So years later, one day, Vincent gets the opportunity to take the place of a man named Jerome Morrow, who's a top-notch human valid who nonetheless became paralyzed from the waist down. Through an elaborate scheme, Vincent uses Jerome's urine, hair, blood, and skin samples to pose as him and get a job at Gattaca to become a navigator for a mission to Titan. In return, Jerome gets a portion of Vincent's salary so they can live life well together. All is going fine until there's a murder at Gattaca. Then a foreign eyelash, Vincent's, is found in the office, and police assume an invalid has committed the murder.
The eyelash? What do you know about?
It's an unregistered invalid. He was a janitor here until a few years back when he disappeared out of sight.
So the specimen could have been here since then.
Well, take a look at the floor, so I don't think anything lays around here for very long.
Because it's too much of a coincidence. Irene Cassini, played by Uma Thurman, tries to investigate, but Vincent falls in love with her, and she falls in love with him. She's genetically modified, a valid, but still has a heart issue that would prevent her from joining the Titan mission.
What about you, Irene? You're engineered just like the rest of us.
Not quite like the rest of you. An acceptable likelihood of heart failure. I think that's what the manual says. The only trip I'll take in space is around the sun and the satellite right here.
Well, if there's anything wrong with you, I can't see it from where I'm standing.
That's one thing that kind of connects Vincent to her. Jerome is found to also have his failings. He became paralyzed after trying to kill himself after coming in second at a swim meet. Pretty heavy. Vincent again and again narrowly avoids detection until finally it's discovered that the mission director killed the guy who made to make sure that the mission would go on as he wished.
So the invalid had nothing to do with this?
No. Our friend here acted alone. This mission meant everything to him, didn't it?
Vincent finds that it was actually his brother Anton, now an investigator, who closed the case. The two meet and engage in a game of chicken again.
In case you haven't noticed, I don't need any rescuing. But you did once. Well, you've got all the answers. How do you explain that?
You didn't beat me that day. I beat myself.
Who are you trying to convince?
You want me to prove it to you?
It's not important, Anton. It's forgotten.
I'll prove it to you. You want me to prove it to you? I'll prove it to you!
Swimming out as far as they can at night. Again, Vincent must rescue Anton. They have a reconciliation of sorts. On the day Vincent is to go to Titan, Jerome says he's stored all the DNA Vincent will need to keep living as a valid.
I have your samples ready.
I don't need any samples where I'm going. You might when you get back. Everything you need to last you two lifetimes. Why have you done all this?
So Jerome will always be here when you need him.
But Vincent realizes too late that he actually doesn't have any DNA on him to get through the final check onto the shuttle. However, the doctor who's been testing him reveals that he knows who Vincent is and that Vincent gives him hope for his own son to achieve his dreams.
Unfortunately, my son's not all that they promised. But then who knows what he could do.
While Vincent shoots into space, Jerome sadly sets himself on fire on Earth. And the end. I would love to begin specifically by maybe talking about architecture, because it was very, very important in this movie. And in fact, the locations managers had a hell of a time finding all of the things that they wanted and needed. So they said, quote, "To this day, it's the only movie I was scouting for an angle or a curve or the side of a building. The Great Western Forum was used for the DNA testing center. All we used was the outside colonnade, which curves and has the ticket window, but we needed to have that curve. End quote. So you have these locations managers who are like, you know, this is 20 years later when they were doing this interview, and they were like, this was the most difficult project that we worked on, to try to find these places that had these very specific architectural pieces in them. And I feel like I can see that in this movie, especially noticing it, where people are in the story and how their emotions are reflected. And I was hoping that you could talk about that kind of thing of finding locations, and also finding locations that are extremely particular to a moment or a scene in a film. Like, what kind of lengths would you go to find the perfect location?
Well, it's so interesting that you say that, because like Gattaca has a lot of it's so striking. That's what you can remember like 20 years later. Oh my God, it was amazing. Mm-hmm. And it has, in a way, static shots. It will compose like this beautiful, I think, wouldn't you say pretty much that? There'll be a beautiful shot, you know, which gets that great curve in there. So I see what they mean, that you could actually, that location manager says, if they could find one striking angle, it could work. There didn't, maybe didn't even need to be a reverse or anything. Now, in some films, that doesn't work, because we are doing more 360 shots. We might be doing action. We have more movement. So I think my shooting style, for example, is a bit more camera movement. So it wouldn't be about the one static, poetic, amazing shot. That. So that's fascinating that they were really trying to create this kind of retro futuristic look instead of, and also on, I would assume, probably a limited budget. You might know more about the budget than...
Yeah, $15 million, I think, was the original budget. I think it got bumped up to 20 just in terms of having to finish the film, but it was between 15 and 20. So.
Right. And so that's a case where you don't have the money on a huge, futuristic sci-fi movie to build giant, gorgeous sets that have like, spectacular lighting, like all white glowing sets. You have to think what, and that's kind of what we had to do too. We had to think, what can we use? How can we create a future that's only the near distant future? You know, in our case, it was supposed to be 15 minutes into the future, that still felt a little bit worn, like used, and wasn't slick, but it was more realistic and grounded in a way. So we kind of used the same concept in a way that they did. I mean, they used Marin County Civic Center, I believe, designed by Frank Lloyd Wright, which was designed way back, earlier, the 60s, I guess. And so we used one of our futuristic buildings was designed in the late 70s. It was Art Center, in Pasadena, which is beautiful modern building, which is a sleek bridge, across a gully or a canyon. And it's classic architecture because it was beautiful at the time it was built, and it stayed just classic, but it's not super, it's not cutting edge 2020 architecture. Mm-hmm. So it had that kind of retro future. And we also, in our case, we used, I think they might have too, we used some case study houses, from 50s modern case study houses. And then we decorated them in a different way than you normally see those houses decorated.
I think another part of the locations here too is, so the production design of this movie Gattaca is, phenomenal, because it's both kind of like simple and sleek, but pretty complex in the way that it's materialized. And we had this quote about, the production design. It's a quote, Jan's team, and Jan is the production designer. Jan's team did a number of sketches of the interiors we'd build on a soundstage and match to the exteriors. For the Gattaca computer room, we shot the interior in West Los Angeles in a warehouse. The main computer hall was also the entrance to Gattaca, the liftoff port, and was the training room. It was used many ways, and we had to schedule that very carefully to give the art department time to change it over, end quote. So, I mean, that's a different kind of stress of like knowing, you know, obviously you're going to have a complete production schedule of when things have to go, but when it's really tight and you have one location that has to be redressed again and again and again, it seems like and they really, really redressed it. It seems like there's an extra pressure there specifically on your art department to kind of like meet those needs of the budget. They did quite well in Gattaca, but there's also a lot.
Well, having been a production designer on a lot of movies, on the first probably 5 or 6 movies I production designed, people would say that same concept. Okay, why don't you reuse this space? We'll reuse the walls. You're going to redress it. And so I'd be like, okay, that sounds great. I love that recycling. And then the actor for set number 2 would get another job, and suddenly we'd have to move like the second set up to tomorrow, and then that actor would have to go away, and we'd have to go back to the same set and then go back to the other and back to the other one like 3 different times. Finally, and it didn't always work out very well. So finally, yeah, I said, look, I don't want to do that anymore. Let me find any other way, because I can't control the actors if they get sick or their schedule or anything.
Yeah.
So I said, if there's any other way we can stage this besides having to redress the sets, let's do it. And I would always just like rack my brains to find new ways to lower the cost so that I didn't have to do that anymore, because it's very stressful. Yeah.
I mean, that's because, well, what if they have to do, like, what if they missed something and then you have to redress it for the thing that you already shot? I mean, that seems like it would be a nightmare.
I was on a show where we did have to go back a few times, back and forth, and it was just kind of like, okay, this is not my favorite plan anymore. But, you know, we always have a lot of pressure in the art department because let's say they shot in Marin County Civic Center. Usually, you know, you make a deal with the county and say, we're going to come in and we can dress it for our movie in only 6 hours or 12 hours. And you're paying by the hour. So, you know, the production wants to spend the least amount of time there. So you have to come in. The art department has to be like an army. Like, we have to know. We have 7 set dressers, the, you know, 6 of these people, 3 electricians, the trucks are going to roll in. I mean, it is literally like a cool army operation to maximize setting it up and then striking it and restoring it back to how it was. So art departments are like miracle workers.
I mean, at that point, that must have given you also the confidence to be like, oh, I could probably direct too.
Well, I got to work with so many very smart, you know, directors that I admire. And I would see, you know, some things that were maybe difficult that they did, but, you know, or maybe I wouldn't want to follow that lead, but I would learn every, you know, I would just be like a sponge observing every technique that they use, how to get a different performance out of the actors. You know, Cameron Crowe is famous for playing a different piece of music if he wants to change the mood for the actors. David O. Russell is, you know, he's got all his energy and his passion is right there. And he's right in the middle of it and really revs everybody up. Richard Linklater is much more laid back and just plants the seeds and gives the suggestion and then walks away and lets grow for the act in the actor's mind. Mm-hmm. So I saw all these different methods. It was really cool. Like, when to use that technique, when to use that one, when to use that one.
Yeah, then you don't have to be any one type of director. You just get what you want. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit more Gattaca and also just Catherine's long, industrious career. We'll be right back.
Well, Adam, we're still putting out the Greatest Discovery podcast while we wait for season 2.
What are we doing with these episodes?
We've talked to a whole bunch of interesting people, like The Wall Street Journal's Ben Fritz and MaximumFun.org's own Danielle Radford. We're kind of using this time to find ways to entertain ourselves and you while we wait for the next season.
So catch yourself up with Star Trek Discovery and join us Tuesday on The Greatest Discovery. It's on MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today by Catherine Hardwick, who's over on the other side of town, but it feels like she's right here with me and my cat. We're talking about Gattaca. So something that you said before the break is a great segue for me to talk about different styles of directing, because Ethan Hawke had actually just worked with Richard Linklater, the project before Gattaca. And so he had a little bit of adjusting to go with that. And he said, quote, "Andrew wants to shoot buildings all day. He can if he wants. He's the director. He's very meticulous, and it was difficult for me. The movie I did right before was Before Sunset, where anything went. Linklater would say, okay, let's get you and Julie on the train and just be. With Andrew, the writing is so specific and so good that it warrants doing it the right way. The truth of the matter is that if you believe what you're working on has some value beyond self-glorification, it makes it really easy," end quote. So it's interesting that you had brought up Linklater and the way that he works. I mean, he's kind of famous for that, but it was hard for Ethan Hawke to come right off of that movie to go into completely different style. And if you hear interviews of him, because this is from an interview that happened like right after they shot it and like right before the movie was coming out, you have interviews with him now. He's just like, actually, that was just like a great experience. Like, it was really frustrating for me at the time because I was so used to just like fly by the seat of my pants, and I couldn't figure out why he was setting up these shots for so fucking long. But, you know, in hindsight, he was just like, that was amazing. I'm so happy that I did that right after Linklater. I'm curious about when you get a star in your movie, an actor who just came off of a movie who has worked very differently or had a very different process, who might even be in a different state of mind, you know, how you can kind of get them into your mode of working.
What I think that's interesting is, you know, usually when you're a director and you first, you know, meet an actor that might be in your film or you're hoping that you guys are going to get along, you immediately, I try to be sure in that even if I get an hour on Zoom with them or, you know, however you're going to meet with the person in person, that I go ahead and say, you know, honestly, some of the ways that I like to work. Don't just try to make it a happy meeting. Go ahead and say, here are the things that, these things are usually important to me. Does that work for you? How do you like to work? Try to have a really, you know, as meaningful conversation as you can. For example, in a lot of cases, I've found it's very useful for many kind of scenes, movies, to have rehearsal period with the actors. Like 13, you know, Holly Hunter, Evan Rachel Wood are supposed to be mother and daughter, and Brady Corbet, and you're supposed to believe that this is a family, that they have all their little, so it was important that bond happened. They didn't just show up on the day and just be like, hey, I'm supposed to be your mother. Have I ever even touched your hair or not? So they actually spent time living in the house. You know, they spent the night in the house before with all, and they took showers in the house. They cooked in the kitchen. All those things that I like to do to prepare an actor added to the detail, the level of detail that made it feel really real. Like those people really lived in that house and they really had their little things that you have with your family. So that's something. And then in some cases, you wouldn't want to rehearse two characters that are only meeting for the first time in the movie and they aren't getting along. You want to save that rehearsal. So like, I think each project you do, you kind of try to talk to the actors, find out what's going to work for them. You know, like I just worked with Don Cheadle, who's done, 75, you know,
everything,
and worked with so many different directors on his TV shows. And he's a director and a writer and just producer genius. So how can I make him feel good about the process and let his voice be heard? And he has great ideas for his character, of course, you know, so every chance you get as a director to kind of bond and get in sync with the actor. I go to the wardrobe fitting with him. Yeah, let's talk about it. Oh, let's make the clothes a little loose. And he doesn't care about clothes. Then I start learning more when we're just selecting his glasses. I learn more when I hear what he's thinking about the glasses, about the character, or I can throw in what I'm thinking. So, you know, you're trying to get in sync with the person any way you can. And other movies I've done, like Lords of Dogtown and even Twilight, like Lords of Dogtown, we had a skate camp and surf camp. And Twilight, we had baseball camp. So whatever. Anything you can think of that creates like a cool bonding experience that's relevant to the show and helps you get in sync with the actors and feel what they're feeling and see what are the cool things that that actor can do. Something fun with a baseball bat, or, you know, it's all this like getting to the point where you feel comfortable and good about shooting.
The thing is, you're talking about rehearsals. They had about 2 weeks of rehearsals for Gattaca. Ethan Hawke said, quote, "We did about 2 weeks of rehearsals. That's another great thing about a writer-director, is he can adeptly alter the script to fit the performance. If you cast Ernest Borgnine, you make it work for Ernest Borgnine," end quote. Ernest Borgnine is in this movie, if people haven't seen it. He's great. He's wonderful.
Well, I think that's amazing. And that's something that I learned from working with Richard Linklater, too, because the projects I did, I would try to get the set ready the best I could so they could rehearse on the set if they wanted to get the blocking there. And I would see Richard, you know, really listening, you know, paying attention, what's working, what's not working. And I've done that a lot, you know, as we try to, you know, read the lines that are written in the script, but sometimes you're watching it and you're going, this is boring, or nobody's being active enough, or somebody, you know, we didn't go deep enough. You know, if it's a painful scene, how come we stayed on the surface? Let's get in there more, you know, and feel and open it up. So, like, I love that. And I'm there with my computer all the time, you know, how can we make it better? And then sometimes you just say, let's go ahead and improv it. Let's actually say your inner monologue out loud this time. Just everything that you're really feeling, just say it to the person, even though it's going to be a bit too on the nose. Let me hear what you're feeling. And then sometimes out of those exercises, by stretching your muscles, your heart, your soul, your emotions, we find stuff. Yeah, that was really good. Let's put that line in. Let's try it.
I wanted to talk about something that we get into, or I find a lot in my research, is that a filmmaker says that budgetary concerns ended up being a blessing more than a curse. And, you know, of course, that's hindsight. And so I'm sure people are able to say it better later on. But when Nicol was talking about it, he said, you know, asked about why there weren't big special effects for this, you know, sci-fi movie that everyone's like, oh, sci-fi, of course, like special effects. He said, quote, "It was budgetary. Our budget was $15 million, but in the end, I came to really embrace the idea that we didn't have a lot of money. It was a great thing in the end. For instance, the DNA broker, played by Tony Shalhoub, he was going to walk in with a very, very high-tech electronic notepad. I thought, this is going to be great. Then the production people said, well, we can't really afford that. So I eventually just decided, well, he could just go in with a folder of blood. And it's far more visceral and beautiful to me in the end than if he had walked in with some kind of electronic gizmo," end quote. And it's true. I mean, Tony Shalhoub is not in this movie for very long, but he has, you know, his like little mechanical devices. He's not just like, you know, trying to do like an iPhone or something, which is kind of like, it's boring, or trying to do like a quantum leap, you know, like whatever the Ziggy kind of touchpad, you know, magic. He's just got a folder of blood.
Which is amazing. And it's true. We all have to, you know, every director's eyes are bigger than their budgets, of course. And we all dream of these great things. And we put up on our walls all of our images and we want it to be this. And then reality hits. Okay. And that was certainly the case because actually my boyfriend was also working on Westworld 3 at the same time. I knew what they were doing. They're going to Singapore to the greatest. They're making flying cars. And I'm like, oh my God, we have no budget compared to that. So I'll just be like, you know, anxiety attack. But then what I realized is, and I think what was beautiful about Gattaca, it was the near future. And so you saw the rocket ship, you know, he had the visual effect of the rocket ship taking off. One, two, three. I'm not sure how many times. We had things like that too, where it was in the back. You have a shot that's all real images, like he had in the movie, and then you have one element that you add that just takes it into the future. So we had the same thing. Like, you know, we had solar balloons floating over the high school. You know, we had a glowing car, you know, a chaser, solar panels on a car or on a backpack. Just simple little things that we could afford as a visual effect, but they just, and maybe they're almost subliminal, but it just helped you feel like it's in the future. The whole thing did not have spaceships landing and everything, but you had these little touches of kind of set extensions, or, you know, you could call it, or CGI. Yeah.
One thing I thought was really interesting too was how using a bit of sound, a sound effect or some kind of sound design, actually alters the perception of an object and gives it more production value. And I mean this in terms of, quote, Cassini's character, "We used a Citroen convertible, one of only 1,100 that exist in the world, but we added the sound effect of an electric motor as opposed to a gas motor," end quote. So you have like regular cars on the road, but there's the sound effect makes it seem like there's a different kind of car, like it's a you know, a production designed car or something.
I think that when you're in the editing room, I mean, I have a beautiful sound designer, Frank Gaeta. He's worked with me since even, you know, 13 and Twilight and other movies. Mm-hmm. And so I think that that's something amazing. You like you say, it changes your perception of a whole scene, just the sound design. So when we're in the editing room, you know, a lot of editors have gotten quite good at sound design, temporary sound design, and then of course your designer elevates it. So, but when you're in the editing room, it's true. If you're watching a scene and the sound does not feel right, I can't even watch the scene. Nobody gets to see that scene until we fix the sound. You know, it's because it does throw you off. If you heard my, you know, iPad dropping on the table and it sounded spongy or whatever, it just feels wrong, you know. But how can it be better than just accurate? How can it take it to the next level is what you're saying, you know. And sometimes those experiments that you try where you take a sound that you, unexpected sound, that can elevate it into a whole other world.
I mean, in terms of like trying to describe that sound though, that also seems kind of difficult a task.
When I was doing the movie 13, you know, one of the first scenes, Evan Rachel Wood and Nikki Reed, they're hitting each other and they're sniffing and getting high. And Evan says, "I can feel my brain cells popping." And I said to the composer, Mark Mothersbaugh, to get this big, huge, wonderful composer, lead singer of Devo, he's done a lot of great things, Wes Anderson movies, to get him to do my little tiny movie for no money, I said, "Do you think you could create a sound in your music that sounds like brain cells popping?" Okay, he was hooked. He took the job because of that.
I love it. We're going to take another quick break. When we come back, we'll get a little bit more into Gattaca, and then also I've got some fun details to kind of press Catherine on again and again for more stories. So we'll be right back.
Hey, if you like your podcast to be focused and well-researched and your podcast host to be uncharismatic, unhorny strangers who have no interest in horses, then this is not the podcast for you.
Again, what's your deal? I'm Emily.
I'm Lisa.
Our show's called Baby Geniuses.
And its hosts are horny adult idiots. We discover weird Wikipedia pages every episode.
We discuss institutional misogyny.
We ask each other the dumbest questions, and our listeners won't stop sending us pictures of their butts.
We haven't asked them to stop, but they also aren't stopping.
Join us on Baby Geniuses
every other week on MaximumFun.org.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today by Catherine Hardwick, and we're talking about Gattaca. So, you know, we talked about some other practical things that Andrew Niccol was doing for this film, but we haven't gotten into the opening sequence, which was something that the director needed. Like Niccol, it was the last thing that they were going to try to figure out how to shoot, but it was something that he and Chris Watts, the VFX supervisor, had to nail and perfect sometime by the end of the shoot, because it was his like the last thing on his list. So Chris Watts said, quote, Andrew had this idea for a great opening sequence, and there was no money to shoot it at the beginning of the movie, so we figured out how to do this thing together. The skin flakes and hair strands are plastic models created by the visual effects department. We settled on a more traditional high-speed camera approach, building gigantic bigatures of all the objects and shooting all those on a stage that was supposed to look like really close-up view of the makeup table that he's using. Basically, turned on the Photosonic's high-speed camera and shot them dropping out of the sky at 360 frames per second, burned up a lot of film. The hairs were also bigatures, 4 or 5 feet long, and we dropped a bunch of those cables just on the floor, end quote. So if you guys remember from the opening sequence, essentially, we're seeing all of these skin fragments, hairs falling off, the things that they have to kind of like shave off every day to stay hidden and to, you know, keep this charade going. But because they couldn't figure out a way to do anything that would actually show it like so microscopic, because they are microscopic, you can't do that. Like all of the hairs and plastic fingernails and everything, they were all like 4 or 5 feet long. They're huge. I love bigatures so much. I love models so much. I love the creative ways that people try to problem solve all of these things. And for that, I was just like, this is one of those great stories that I enjoy about movies. I mean, how do you navigate what you want to do, animated CGI versus practical, this very old school way that that even you yourself had kind of come up in with filmmaking?
I mean, I think that now, you know, like we still, like even on Don't Look Deeper, we went to Tony Gardner's Alterian Studios shop and actually did some of the, you know, real prosthetics on the arm, and like when we reveal what's underneath Helena's skin. So mm-hmm. we did, like, he showed us all the different methods he could do for that we could work practically. We yeah. had practical applications for the more visible robots, and then we worked together with the CGI company Engine Room to figure out, you know, how far should we take it. What made sense to do practically, and then how could they enhance it, you know? Yeah. So we really did a combination, an integrated, you know, fusion of both old school and new school techniques.
I mean, going further into that kind of practical idea of having the props and physical things on set, the props woman, the art director, she was very excited about working on this movie because, quote, she said, when I first heard about the project, I was working on a movie with Danny DeVito, who also produced this movie. And he said, you're going to love this movie. It's all about props. There are all these great props, urine and semen and blood. I was like, oh, goody. But every prop was a challenge. All of them would be under great scrutiny. So we made things like a glass vacuum cleaner so we could actually see all that stuff, end quote. And yeah, she has to make a lot of urine. She had to make a lot of blood samples, like all those little castle things that he puts on his fingertip that he fills up with blood from a syringe, the syringes, every little thing. Like there's so much to do with props, and that's not something that I was really thinking about while I was watching this. But like, yeah, if the props sucked, I would notice. I'm curious for you, if you've got a prop or, you know, a specific piece of the production design that you know is going to be in, you know, seen in great detail in a close-up, something like that. Are you telling your art department, like, look, this needs to be extremely clean, good, you know, like, how are you conveying that?
We cannot see a drop of hot glue dripping off the back. Yeah. I think what we have is we have like show and tells that are kind of regularly scheduled with the props department. So mm-hmm. like the very first show and tell during prep, you might see the sketches or you might the ideas or magazine photos or some, you know, prototype version. But by the second or third show and tell, you know, I've got to be able, the director has to be able to hold it. If it zips, unzip it, shake it out, watch every detail and look at it. So we're really talking very closely with the prop master and the creator, you know, to understand. And then we're showing them, you know, filming like it's going to be this close, you know, and you're holding it. It's not just like you see a photo of these key props. You are holding it in your hand.
Yeah.
You're making sure you can actually hit that button and the thing comes out. You know, whatever the function is supposed to be, does it work every time? Does it work?
Something that I wanted to get into as we were kind of wrapping up has to do with the things that you maybe wish that you had kept. So this movie, all about, you know, eugenics and the dangers therein and, you know, like the needing and wanting a kind of human variety and wanting to preserve that. And so there were big ideas that Andrew Niccol was playing with. And he was, you know, kind of frightened by science and where it was heading. And the end sequence that they had, they nixed it. They decided they didn't need it. But they said, quote, "The ending sequence we removed was the genetic hall of fame of sorts. It talked about all the people who wouldn't have been born if this society had gone with eugenics. Lincoln, Van Gogh, Emily Dickinson, Einstein, JFK, people who had a profound effect on history. And if they didn't have their genetic issue, they'd never been born. We decided to cut it out because the movie itself made the point and we didn't want to hit the audience over the head. But over the years, we've all regretted making that decision." You know, there's always regrets, I think. Well, not always, but there's sometimes regrets where you look back on something and you're like, man, I wish I could have kept that. Or I wish that maybe we had the money to finish the special effects on that so we could have kept that. Do you have any moments like that where you're like, oh, this would have been amazing, or I made the wrong decision, or this could have been so great?
Well, it's fun. Like in 13, my first movie, there was in my lookbook for it, my whole presentation, I had a whole sequence where the two 13-year-old girls were like, had fantasies about themselves being in movies and being in commercials and being fabulous, you know, and I never got to shoot it because of, you know, that was way too expensive. And ultimately, I think the movie worked fantastic without it, you know, and nobody would ever know about that or no one would miss it. You were really with, you know, Evan Rachel Wood the whole time. Would that have, but I wanted to do it. I thought that would have added a whole other level about society and, you know, aspirations and false aspirations or whatever. And we could have created something amazing that would be, you know, loved, but we never got to do it. So, you know, I had to kind of be like that, you know, like I can let it go. And just, you know, we don't have that extra $100,000 or whatever. And we just didn't have it, you know.
Is it hard to let it go, though? Or was it hard to let it go?
It kind of is. You know, Twilight, I had a whole beautiful, like, underwater sequence. And then I had a whole lot more ideas that I was going to do, snow and this and that. And then when the budget hammer came down, all that went, you know, by the wayside. Mm-hmm. It still worked without it. And we had to be creative and just... Okay, David O. Russell, the movie Three Kings. I was a production designer on that. And that stars George Clooney and Mark Wahlberg and Ice Cube. It's a really cool movie. But he wanted to do the movie because he wanted to build this beautiful Mosque of Samarra that he'd seen a photo of it in Iraq. And so that was one reason why he wanted to do the movie. And I looked at that and I'm like, well, how could I possibly afford to build this on any budget we had? I said, maybe I could build just like the bottom half and then CGI the top. And then I couldn't even afford to build the bottom wall. Then finally, what's in the movie is a poster. I got $200 permission from National Geographic to have a poster of it on one wall in a scene. And that's all that's left of his grand idea. The movie came out great, but there's one poster.
Catherine, I want to thank you for coming on the show today and sharing all these wonderful stories about your career. I really appreciate it. It's a pleasure to speak with you. And again, your show is going to be on Quibi, and we should all keep an eye out for it. Maybe by the time this episode airs, it will be out.
Don't look deeper, Don Cheadle. Emily Mortimer and newcomer Helena Howard is amazing. So
wonderful. Yeah, yeah. Thank you so much, Catherine.
Yeah, thank you. Fantastic research you had, by the way. Thanks.
And thank you for listening to Switchblade Sisters. We're going to start doing something a little different, and you may have heard if you've been listening to episodes since we've been in quarantine, but I'm trying to give you guys a staff pick that kind of jibes with the movies that we're talking about for every episode. But each one is going to be directed by a woman. And so the pick for today is a sci-fi movie, and I am about to butcher this woman's name, but she's Lithuanian, and I am not familiar with pronunciations there. But it's Christina, and I'm going to say, like, Bojite, maybe? Her movie, Vanishing Waves, which if you have Shudder, it is available to stream there, and I think you can get it VOD other places. But it's a 2013 sci-fi film that is non-linear nightmare trip through this world of sex and science magic, the scientist connects his consciousness to that of a comatose woman and then engages in these sometimes thrilling and sometimes terrifying erotic romps through a dreamscape of their minds. Hard to describe, very interesting to watch. Maybe check it out. I love it when women get into sci-fi. So if you want to let us know what you think of the show, you can tweet at us at SwitchbladePod or email us at SwitchbladeSisters@MaximumFun.org. And please check out our Facebook group too. That's facebook.com/groups/SwitchbladeSisters. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. And this is a production of MaximumFun.org.
You want me to prove it to you? I'll prove it to you!
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.